This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 313 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along, beginning with chapter 48, entitled Strangers in the Night.
You know, I mean, I'm not going to do it here, but you know when I was taking notes that I was singing in my head because of this chapter title. So Claire's done dressing wounds and looking after her patients. And of course, the last time we were with her in chapter 47, because of the celebrations after the wedding, the people were drunk and celebratory, and they were shooting into the air, and some people got shot and hurt. So there's all kinds of stuff
clearly
going on.
They weren't shooting in the air.
Well, right? They weren't doing it because they were drunk. They apparently didn't know what up meant.
Shooting in the air.
What direction up was? Like,
nobody was up, but I mean, no, that's not how that works.
They tried to, but they didn't do it.
I mean, bullets that go up have to come down, but still, you don't get shot in the side from an up bullet.
Yeah, from an up bullet as opposed to a down bullet. So she's finished dressing wounds and caring for her patients as much as she can. And she is emotionally, physically, all the stuff ready for bed. And quote, Betty was in what looked, she did check on Betty before she went up. Quote, Betty was in what looked like a deep but natural sleep, snoring loudly in bed, unquote. And young Jemmy was better. He had no fever, so he was doing better. So she goes into the house and into Jocasta's rooms in that area, and everyone's in for the night. Everyone's done.
No, they're all in for the night in one room. I don't understand the concept of how this was like an appropriate thing to do.
Well, it wasn't bundling, but it was...
They were bundled in there. There was a bunch of them in there. I mean...
That's true.
I don't know how many...
It was all women, though.
It was all women, but they were all like laying in a bed together, like for
and on the floor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm like, this.
It's okay. Don't worry. You don't have to fret, Summer. Whenever we go somewhere, I'm your bed buddy. It's okay.
That's not true.
Who is your? No, we don't need to talk about bed buddies. Unless we're talking about Comic-Con, then it's always me and Sarah.
Or Mandy.
sorry, you and Mandy?
It's me and Mandy.
It's always you and Mandy. So everyone, as Summer was saying, was crammed together. Women were on the floor, quote, radiating as much moist heat as a greenhouse full of orchids, unquote. That was kind of nasty.
There's nothing about this chapter that's not nasty. I don't know why you're
it's a few chapters.
Attempting
it's a few chapters that are nasty.
Yeah, this is not a pleasant chapter.
So she's... takes off her gown and her shoes and lies down on her shift, and she's thinking of Jamie. Now, she hadn't seen him among any of the card players.
She had popped in or thinking.
Thinking. She hadn't seen him among any of the card players. She had gone to, you know, to pop in, and she didn't see him. She hadn't seen the dandy macaroni either. She tells herself, you know, Jamie wouldn't do anything stupid.
Wouldn't he?
Quote, but it was not like him to retire without coming to wish me good night, no matter what the circumstances, unquote. And that's why she was worried. So she falls asleep and she's having like dreams as a horse and of horses.
This is becoming a common theme with her. Hasn't she had dreams about having sex with horses before?
And I swear it was about the Ireland thing too, King of Ireland, because early in the book, it opened with that.
I remember you bringing it up and me being very confused.
Yes. She was a white mare and Jamie was a stallion. What he was saying to her as he bit her neck was, quote, I am the king of Ireland. And then she came awake. That does harken back to their conversation about how the kings of Ireland were crowned or what they did, you know, back in the day. So, yes, it's definitely related to the dream that was earlier on in this book. She... came awake, though, to someone basically playing with, tickling, massaging with her foot. And then holding it.
Now, this begins what is several chapters of whodunit. And the only thing I can say about that is that, as confusing as it is, I'm fairly positive that I've recently saw Diana Gabaldon post something about Philip Wiley not being plausible as playing this little piggy goes to market.
Let me get to the end of a scene, and then I'll tell you two things with that exact thing in mind, although I was not remembering her comment about this little piggy, but I remember her comment. She said, it's pretty clear who it was if you read it, right? That's what she was implying, and then she mentioned the piggy.
But I would disagree with her, because it was pretty clear to her because she wrote it. But for the rest of us, I didn't think it was pretty clear, especially because Claire didn't think it was pretty clear.
My little piggy, or this little piggy, whatever, this little piggy is definitely a clue, right? It's a huge clue. But there's another thing, like an indirect clue that I thought was, that pretty much seals it. Okay, so she woke up to someone playing with her feet. And she looked, but she could only sense, quote, a hunched figure near her feet, an amorphous blob that shifted like mercury. And then the fingers were up the calf and behind the knee, and then they were on her thigh, and then pressing her legs apart. She takes a deep breath, and she smells rice powder. Now, that's what makes me think of Philip Wiley.
I didn't. I just think she's in a room full of women.
Well,
any one of them could have rice powder on them.
That's true. That's true. So she's worried. She's thinking like, oh my gosh, what is this? That's what scares her. Not necessarily what's being done, but the thought, oh my gosh, if this isn't Jamie, right? And she's worried it might be the dandy.
Well, he was already upset at her for things she hadn't done.
Uh-huh. So yeah, my little comment here I didn't even address what Diana has posted recently, but yeah. So, I wrote, definitely Jamie, though, with the 10 little pigs. So, yeah, that definitely points to Jamie. But something that I don't think I realized before is that, let's say we have no clue who it was, like legit have no clue. When she stands up and wakes up, stands up and goes down the steps in her shift, and she sees Jamie at the foot of the stairs, like trying to call her down with his eyes.
Yeah, but that was discounted for me. Over and over again, because he kept telling her, I kept walking to your door and then leaving. I kept walking to your door and leaving. He never mentioned, I went in there and I diddled you real good.
Nope, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is he's down there at the bottom, regardless of what he says or didn't go in. What I'm saying is, if it were Wiley would have had to go up the stairs and down the stairs, and Jamie would have been right there.
But you don't know how long he was there. And you know, there's a passage of time. She goes back to sleep.
Not for a long time.
It doesn't have to be a long time. There's no guarantee of how long Jamie's standing down there.
It doesn't matter how long he was standing down there. If it were Wiley, she does not, between the finger hand doing what it did and her going, whoa, and like waking up for good and then going downstairs is not a lot of time. So if the dude who diddled her feet, inner thigh, whatever, were Wiley, he would have had to leave before her, obviously, leave the room before her. And since there's not a lot of time between when she actually wakes up and goes downstairs and sees Jamie, to me, that means that if it were Wiley, he would have run into Jamie, or at least Jamie would have seen him walking or running away. I don't think. Add to that the 10 little pigs. It's like there's no, it can't, it has to be Jamie. But the 10 little pigs is definitely more, it's definitely stronger evidence.
I just don't think, we don't know where, look. I'm not saying it was Philip Wiley. I'm just saying that Diana Gabaldon made a very confusing couple chapters here with her who did it, because we don't know where Philip Wiley was sleeping. He might not have had to go back down the stairs. Like, Jamie could have been standing at the base of the stairs and never seen him go in or out of the room and then to another room upstairs. There are potentially many exit routes from that room that we do or don't know about. So I'm just saying that
the more we make allowances, the more for all, you're not wrong, right? There's so many things that if it were him that he could have done. Maybe there's a different way.
I'm just saying it would have been real easy for her to have Jamie say, and then I came in and diddled you. And then it would have put the whole thing to rest, as opposed to this little mini murder mystery that happened in the middle of the chapter.
But if he doesn't know that she was, if he did it, right? And he's not admitting he came up, he doesn't necessarily know that she was awake.
That's even worse. Why are you diddling a person who's asleep? You are not winning any like personality contest right now.
Well, as just before she went downstairs, though, the person, whoever's hand it was, did something. And this is what I don't get. I mean, we can only guess. Did something startling and caused a reaction in her, like an eep or whatever. And that whoever it was got up and left the room. And that she's like, can't sleep. I'm done.
And that was chapter 48. Moving on to chapter 49, entitled In Vino Veritas, which I believe means in wine there is truth, or the truth in wine.
In wine, truth. Yes. Susanna M. writes, In Vino Veritas, of course, referring to the title, is a Latin phrase that means in wine lies the truth, or in wine, truth. The expression is referential to the liberty one feels when drunk, and also the liberty of lust. She lay there for a bit. She's still lying down. No sleepy.
She laid there for more than a bit. She laid there way longer than I would have, not knowing who was diddling me.
She's still thinking about who it was. And she's right. She's like, I can't ask Jamie. If she asked him and it weren't him, he would have gone after the dandy. She finally gets up.
She finally gets up
and heads downstairs. She sees a man at the foot of the stairs. It's Jamie. In the same clothes as before. Now, remember, she's still in her shift. At least I thought. And I went back to read. And then I went forward and I was like, yep, a bit later. Quote, I was naked under my shift. Unquote. So she came downstairs in her shift. As they find another place to do their business, he grabs a maid's cloak to put around her so they don't walk around like basically, she's not basically naked. And they go to the stables and he puts her wedding rings back on her. And they do it.
Where did they do it? More specifically.
On the hay? Oh, actually, no, it was like on hard ground.
It was a hard ground.
It wasn't like hay. She had hay on her hair and everything, but it was rough.
He was real like aggro.
They only get dressed when they hear voices. he'd won after he played the whist. He'd won and then he'd gone to find her. So he was extremely sloshed until after he'd beaten the dandy. So he played, he kept a straight head, played, won.
It was a celebratory slosh.
And what exactly, Summer, had he won? What had he taken from the dandy?
His prized possession, his horse.
Correct. His name, Lucas. The beautiful
Freedom. I mean, he took his stallion, which is kind of like taking his manhood, right?
I guess. And then he says that he plans to sell Lucas, which...
I mean, that's the smart thing to do.
It is.
Because that horse is not of any use to them.
Oh, no. Well, not only that, but also, Jamie, he can... especially in this situation, he could absolutely be... Jamie would... He won him fair and square. I'm not saying he didn't have a right to, like, you know, take the goods that the guy put up. But it would have been a severely D move to, like, take that horse from him. Because Jamie's not that much of a D.
No, it's more of a D move to sell it.
To sell him to someone else.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's more of a D move to sell the horse to someone and be like, thanks for allowing me to win your prize stallion, and now I'm going to sell it. Because I think so little of it.
I don't disagree. That's the more of the D move. Number one, he hasn't done it yet, so we don't know in the chapter, in the book. Yes, we've read the book. I don't remember. Maybe you remember. But I believe the intent, even though he doesn't say it, at least Claire comes away with this thought. She understands it, that he'll sell the horse back to Wiley. That way, Wiley still gets his thing, but they come away with bank. So everyone's happy. Like, he comes away with bank. And Claire has her rings, and Wiley has his horse. So it's actually a win-win-win.
But that's also another D move.
Yeah.
You can have your horse back when you buy it from me.
When you buy it. He's offering it to him, but of course he's not going to give it back. He's not mean, but he's also not stupid. His family needs money.
Look, I'm not on Philip Wiley's side. Please don't take it to mean that. I'm just saying. Jamie is in his D mode tonight.
Oh, he has. He definitely has his moments. And then as they're talking about the potential selling of Lucas, Joshua comes back into the stable with news of Betty. Summit gone amiss, quote. And they're off again. So Susanna M. writes regarding the title, In Vino Veritas is a Latin phrase that means in wine lies truth. In wine, truth. The expression is referential to the liberty one feels when drunk, and also the liberty of lust. Claire and Jamie do feel free with their love after Jamie returns Claire the wedding rings. You may not believe me, but this event kept me from sleeping at night. Diana never closed this page, never tied this knot, and kept me thinking for a long time who the man was. I believe it's Jamie and not Philip Wiley, just because he is right outside when she leaves the room. If it's really Jamie, after I decided that Jamie was the mystery visitor, I wondered how he found her in the middle. Erica B. writes, we start this chapter with Claire awake and reeling from being felt up in the night by an unknown man. Seductive and familiar and yet also super creepy and icky feeling. And I was just reading it. It really is no wonder she can't sleep after that. Who could? Claire gets up out of bed to clear her head and spots.
Depends on how good it was.
You mean like, let me get back to sleep to have some more?
No, I just mean, you know, orgasms are, okay. You know, a release. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes, you know, they help you sleep better when you get that tension out.
Claire gets up out of bed to clear her head and spots Jamie at the bottom of the stairs. He nearly takes her then and there on the stairs, and I'm glad he didn't, for Claire's sake. It would have really hurt her back.
She wouldn't have stopped him. That girl, man.
She's ready. She was happy. Mm. They find their way to the stables where he returns her rings and he takes her very passionately against... Oh, this is what it was. Oh, you're right. It was a wall. Against the brick wall. Mm-hmm. That's how I knew it was like... I don't want to say brick, but there's not brick floor. Brick wall.
No, I remember him being like up against a wall. He's got her impaled. They made it sound like he was like a sword that he impaled her on his sword. And then he kept saying, look down. You have to watch me take you. And I'm like, you're being a creeper, man.
That's a little, Nothing like hot, steamy, sexy time to make your night. It is a bit unsettling that Claire still doesn't know who her nighttime visitor was. Did she dream it as part of Jamie trying to use telepathy to get her out of bed? Who knows at this point? But it's still bothersome. Jamie won Wiley's stallion. Must have been some game for Wiley to lose the beautiful horse. I did have to Google the game Whist and came across the Wikipedia page, which we will share in the show notes, to find out more. What I found most interesting is that there are many different types of games that classify as whist, including hearts and spades, just to name a couple, which folks might be more familiar with. And the chapter ends on a cliffhanger. Something is amiss with Betty. Oh no. Quick, Claire, run! And finally, Megan P. Always enjoy it when Jamie is reduced to just his baser instincts. I wouldn't have been able to stay mad either, confronted with his sexual onslaught. I am glad he didn't lose her rings, and I thought it was cute in a broody man sort of way, the way he was worried she could ever hate him. I do find myself a bit curious as to whether or not Jamie was her nighttime visitor. I'm thinking he would have seen someone else, surely, the way he described going up and down the stairs. Maybe she was so sleep-deprived and aroused that she imagined it? Maybe we will find out. I sure hope we do. Nice, hot, and steamy J&C chapter. Loved it.
I'm just going to put this out there. Nobody fantasizes about this little piggy went to market encounters ever.
Except for this one.
That is never a sexual fantasy.
Except for this one.
That is never something anyone imagines.
If
you're creating
I thought you meant someone
a sexual encounter in your sleepy dreams, it's not going to include this little piggy.
Unless you started having that with someone, like someone did it with you and that was your thing, then you might dream about it down the road.
That's no one's thing. You stop that. That's no one's thing. Ever. Stop it.
Summer.
That is some really bad, like, daddy-mommy issues. So.
Okay.
And that was chapter 49, moving right along to chapter 50, entitled Blood in the Attic. I feel like we're going to go to the attic and that there's going to be
a little bit of blood, maybe?
Maybe.
Quote, the attic room looked like the scene of a murder, and a brutal one at that.
It was.
Unquote. Betty was in pain, holding onto her stomach. Dr. Fentiman was with her. Before Claire could reach Betty, she coughed, gushed more blood from the mouth and nose, and went limp. She was gone. Claire gets Fentiman's attention. She means to take him downstairs, and she'll send up some people to take care of Betty. But then one of the slaves says that someone must go tell Fedra. We find out that Betty was her mother. Duncan comes up the stairs with Jamie. The two of them arrange to get to take Betty downstairs and have her taken care of. Now, Duncan, now master of this place, says that he'll take care of her. Claire takes Dr. Fentiman out, and she wraps him in another of the cloaks, like the one she was put in, and leads him along the side of the property. They sit down on a bench under some willow trees, and she finds out from him that he'd been roused before dawn. Betty had been complaining of stomach pains. She hadn't been bleeding at all when he was with her before. Now, she frogs him out.
What? She frogs him out? That's not a verb.
It's a split infinitive in German. So I was reading it and I was like, oh, because the first thing that came like, oh, she's frogging him aus.
Nope, she didn't frog a mouse.
She did. Ausfragen, to interrogate someone, to ask someone questions.
Mouse frog.
I didn't say mouse. I said she frogs him aus.
Yeah. I like kept hearing she frogs a mouse.
Anyway, the verb in German, ausfragen, jemanden, I think, jemanden.
Ask a question.
Jemandem, I think. Jemandem ausfragen, which means basically to interrogate. But interrogation doesn't have to be like like a Nazi interrogation, right? That's what I think of. Like, interrogate is such a strong word. It just means asking someone questions. It can be brutal or not. Anyway, that came to my brain right away.
When you were frogging mouths.
Anyway, I thought, besides the fact that it popped up, that popped up. Popped Girl. Into my mind. It made me laugh, but it also sounds kind of, it sounds kind of, to me, it sounds like kind of dirty. She frogged a mouse.
Frogging a mouse does sound dirty. I don't even know how one does that.
She frogged him aus. Which is like,
leave those mice out of this.
Eating yay, im hay, out yay.
No one said that. Just you. Just you.
That's what I'm saying. That's why it sounded
gross. To be clear, frogging a mouse could also be a euphemism for that.
Summer. Stop it. Okay. So she asks some questions. She questions him gently to try and get to the bottom of just what happened to Betty.
She's trying to get to his bottom. You need to stop frogging his mouse, man.
Or frogging his bottom. Mm-hmm. Into this scene, the dandy inserts himself.
Stop inserting things into her mouth frogging. Also, how does he always happen to be in those places? Does he never do anything by himself? Does he just wander aimlessly and not sleep, looking for opportunities to pop up and be annoying?
This is the first time he's popped up so far. We're not at the other one yet.
During the mouse frogging?
Correct. So the dandy inserts himself, he comes in, and he thinks they're canoodling.
Stop like saying that. That sounds worse than frogging a mouse.
He's all ready to make, not claims, to
no,
make.
No, he shows up and he's accusing her of being a loose woman because she's comforting in a doctoral way. But she's like half naked and he is and also. Both,
so is he, and they're covered in blood. So. Yeah.
He doesn't see the blood. Oh. He just sees the half nakedness.
The dude's covered in a cloak. So Fentiman is like the furts, and he totally defends her. And he's like, come along, Mrs. Fraser. I was trying to say a politely way of saying duffer. And then he escorts her away and they leave Wiley behind.
I love how he's like, come, good lady. We're leaving this place and screw this man as he's haughty.
Puppy. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's like, he's all like nose
they're dressed
in
finery. Yes.
Right. And they're both in like slaves capes, like borrowed clothing.
As they walk away, she lifts her hand, quote, and gave him a small wave of farewell, unquote. The light sparked off
giving him a one finger salute.
Oh, Summer. The light sparked off her gold ring and he stiffened.
She should have finished it saying, I'm about to go pet your horse. My horse.
And Dr. Fentiman is ready for breakfast.
He's going to go frog that mouse, y'all.
That's the title. You're so bad. Frogging a mouse. And it's going to be spelled F. I just spit on myself. It's going to be spelled F-R-A-G-G.
No, I-N-G. You need to spell it frog the mouse because that's what it sounds
oh,
like.
Frog the mouse?
F-R-O-G.
Okay.
T-H-E-M-O-U-S-E.
No, no. F-R-A-G. The. I'll put M-A-U-S. No, okay. I'll make a compromise. F-R-A-G. The. Or whatever. M-O-U. I'll put mouse, like normal mouse, like an English mouse.
But see, it's funnier if you have the whole thing say frog the mouse, because that's what it sounded like the first time you said it.
I understand that.
I can't stop you from naming the things the way that I think they should be named. You never listen, so.
I listen. I do.
But you're not going to adjust.
I just gave you mouse.
Yeah, well, you're not listening to the things that would actually be funnier to a larger audience and not just the audience of one, which is you and maybe Martina P.
Martina, I love you. I apologize for my Schwester.
Was that the end of that chapter?
No.
Oh, you have some listener comments?
Yes.
All right, have at.
Hannah S. As a new contributor, welcome,
Ginger,
Hannah.
Ginger. What? Are you sure it's not Hannah?
It's H-A-N-N-A.
That doesn't mean it's not Hannah. I'm just saying, I feel like you're skewing this way Germaner than it needs to be.
Germaner. Okay, either way, it's Hannah or Hannah. Hannah, whichever it is, please let us know what it is so in the future we can make sure we get it right.
What's her last name? That'll give you a clue.
I don't give last names. It's S.
Well, yeah, but you can give it to me.
I don't want to
have it. Give it to me, babe.
I don't have it. It's in my other email account.
Okay, fine. Bye.
Hannah S. Welcome, new contributor. She writes, Claire takes Dr. Fentiman outside, since he appears quite shaken. On the way out, they pass Hector Cameron's mausoleum and a, quote, growth of ornamental yew bushes.
Mm-hmm. But will they?
Unquote.
Will they?
So I thought Summer, and this is Ginger speaking, not Hannah or Hannah. Ginger, I'm saying, Summer, you will definitely appreciate the next few comments.
Will I?
Totally.
Don't put words in my mouth.
Quote, the yew tree is another of our native
trees.
What did you say?
I said, oh, good Jesus Christ. That's what I just said.
The yew tree is another of our native trees, which was held sacred by the Druids in pre-Christian times.
This person has listened to our podcast.
I was about to say.
And they're trying to out-ginger Ginger.
Tree's qualities of longevity and regeneration. Drooping branches of old yew trees can root and form new trunks where they touch the ground. And the yew came to symbolize death and resurrection in Celtic culture. They will also have been familiar with the toxicity of the tree's needles, in particular, which can prove fatal, and which may have further contributed to its connections with death. Shakespeare, too, was familiar with these qualities when he had Macbeth concoct a poisonous brew, which included slips of yew slivered in the moon's eclipse.
It was a yew brew.
Unquote. That's true. Did you just make that up?
Yes.
That's cute. Also, quote, in the Highlands, the tree seems for a long time to have been rare in the wild, though notwithstanding this, Clan Fraser adopted a sprig of yew as their clan badge. And she also provides a link for that source. They end up sitting on a stone bench by a river under a weeping willow, as I mentioned. Quote, there are references to the willow tree in Celtic and Christian tradition. One of the most valuable traits of the willow tree is its flexibility. The willow tree is one of the few trees that is capable of bending in outrageous poses without snapping. This can be a powerful metaphor for those of us seeking recovery or a spiritual path. The message of the willow tree is to adjust with life rather than fighting it, surrendering to the process. Unquote. And finally, quote, we can also look at how the willow tree encourages the expression of deep emotions, including grief and sadness, through tears, and teaching us the value and consequences of love and loss. One of the greatest symbolic meanings of the willow tree is that even through great loss, we have the ability to grow, and there is potential for something new. And that she also provides a source for that. We'll link all of the links that were given to us in the show notes. The themes of flexibility and expression of emotions are both present in this scene. Claire is flexible in her supportive role for Dr. Fentiman, despite her strained feelings for him. And Dr. Fentiman shares the sadness he feels for losing a patient. Now, Dr. Fentiman also mentions at the very end that he feels he betrayed Jocasta's hospitality by trying to help, but being unable to save one of her, a slave, like a piece of property. And Hannah asks, in general, was it common for slave owners to seek recompense for slaves' deaths? I think it depends on the owner. This is my uneducated in this, you know, topic opinion. I think obviously it was up to the owner, but also the manner of death, right? If someone's really sick and you're attending them, you can't, you know, and they were sick before you got there, you can't really be blamed. It's unfortunate, but if you introduce something that, you know, may have caused their death, then yeah, I think in a lot of times, in a lot of situations, the owners, you know, had every right to be angry, but definitely, I don't know, do something.
And moving right along to chapter 51, entitled Suspicion.
The bride and groom are now the happy couple. And now that they are married and it's the next day and the feasting and everything is done, the guests begin to depart after breakfast. As we said earlier, Jemmy is doing even better. Claire had brought Dr. Fentiman to the house and left him with Ulysses to be looked after. And now she goes to look in on Fedra. Fedra was silent and still, and in the end, to help her at least have a chance of relaxing and, you know, kind of getting through the shock, the immediate shock a little more easily, she dosed her with some laudanum. And when she checked on her again, she was finally sleeping.
I wonder if she got in trouble for that.
Giving her laudanum?
No, not Claire. Fedra, for taking a nap.
Oh, I doubt it. Her mom just got whacked.
We're not going to assume that that matters to most people of the time.
Maybe.
Because they didn't really treat anybody like they were anything other than their own property. They never took into account. I say never. I wasn't there. I'm sure they rarely took into account the fact that the familial connections between any of the people, because they never had any problem selling them out from under each other.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree. But I think with at least this is fiction. And I think with Jocasta, I think especially, you know, being told what just happened to her mom and on her property, I think she would have not been upset that Fedra was sleeping off the shock.
She was sleeping off the laudanum.
Yeah. So Claire goes back to the bedroom that she'd been in and gets her clothes back on or something on. She changes. I mean, we're not told that she bathes, do we? Are we?
I don't recall a bath scene.
Yeah. But she ends up falling asleep. And she awakes just before sunset. Jamie had come to lie with her sometime during the day. When she wakes up, she finds out that they hadn't yet buried Betty.
She went straight up detective on his ass. She's like, I woke up and there was an indent in the pillow and a telltale a red hair.
Yes. Where's Cumberbatch? They'd washed the body and put it in a shed near the kitchen garden. But Jocasta wants to wait till the next day to bury her so as not to trouble the guests. Like, she doesn't want a funeral as people are, you know, leaving. She doesn't want to, like, let it be known widely, just, you know, bring down the mood. And
we don't want that to be the thing everybody remembers about my wedding.
No. Claire just knows that there was something wrong with this death. She has a feeling that it wasn't natural.
Well, you don't go from sleeping your drunk off to vomiting blood.
Yes. Correct. And she has an even deeper feeling that someone killed her. She's not sure who, but she believes and feels her death was wrong.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Before the autopsy, the weird autopsy that takes place in the next chapter, did they not find weird stuff in the cup they found her with in the first place?
Only like laudanum.
Was that it? I thought there was... Mm-hmm. I thought there was
no.
More
it was
stuff.
Different smells. It was different smells they had found, and they were. She was trying to find other cups like it. So Duncan's cups, trying to see anything else that they could, get another. Basically, because whatever was in it was mostly gone. There was like maybe, you know, stuff dried to the sides, like whatever laudanum or whatever was in it. She could still smell it and smell it on Betty. But that's partly why they were trying to see if they would. Trying to see if they could find another one of the cups in case it was filled with something similar in hopes to also be taken by Duncan or whoever was the target. And I don't think they ever found it, but she was hoping that if they found something that would have had the same stuff, she could have, if not identified it, at least examined it. So Claire's sure that this was wrong and that she was killed, and she thinks there might be one way to tell for sure.
It's like the Alzheimer's of the time.
So Hannah, or Hannah, asks, she says, before she prepped for these chapters, she didn't read the prior chapters just before it. And she's asking, she said, did they give, I guess, yeah, I think they mean Fentimin or Claire, did they give her mother, meaning Betty, laudanum before she died? So as far as we know Claire didn't give her really anything, right? She barely got to do much with her. But Dr. Fentimin,
he mostly just bled her.
He bled her. He gave her an enema and he gave her, well, and we find out later that she had ipecac, but he bled her. Exactly. He bled her and he gave her an enema basically. But if you remember, and that's, I'm going back to what Summer asked about, like, did they find something in the glass or in the cup? Well, that's kind of why they wanted to find the cup so they could see more of like what she had imbibed or taken in. Because when she was first called up to Betty, before she saw Fentimin or anything, when she was first called up to Betty, or when they first found Betty's sleeping body, right? Like on the dung heap, she was stinking like a brew house, but it wasn't just alcohol. One of the smells was laudanum. So no, Claire didn't give her laudanum. Pretty sure.
No, she just gave Fedra laudanum.
Oh, I know. But her question was, did they give her mother laudanum? And I think the reason she's thinking of that, either she's mixing it up with Fedra, but she says her mother, so I don't think she's getting her mixed up with Fedra. There was laudanum associated with Betty, but that was in the thing that she believed she smelled it on her, especially once she vomited the first time, not the bloody scene, but the first time when she was up there, because I think it's called an emetic, and they may have used a different word, but when Claire was first up there and she reaches up there, actually it was after Fentimin was there. Fentimin had given her an emetic. It's something to help her or to make her vomit. And it was, she vomited after Ipecac? She got up there. I don't know that it was Ipecac at that point. He gave it to her later. But he definitely gave her something earlier. And Claire was there after Fentimin got there, but before she vomited. She witnessed her vomit. There was nothing like, you know, it's like not blood or anything in it. But it was with the vomit you smelled, like you smelled the smell of vomit. You smelled all the stuff that she had drunk. And that confirmed she smelled laudanum again. And that confirmed her suspicion that whatever was in that drink that she had gotten her so toasted or so passed out included laudanum. So that maybe, I'm just saying all of that for Hannah or Hannah's benefit, because she was asking, did they give her mother laudanum? No one except if anyone gave her laudanum, it was the murderer.
And that was chapter 51. And now we are going to finish this week's The Fiery Cross read along with chapter 52, which is the third chapter of the evening with a song title as the title. This one is A Hard Day's Night.
They'd put Betty in a small tool shed outside the kitchen garden. Claire has decided to perform an autopsy on Betty. Jamie, who has serious feels about the desecration of a body, doesn't like it, but he believes in her and will support her and protect her if she feels.
He doesn't believe in her. He's just like, I clearly am not going to be able to stop you. So the least I can do is make sure nobody else hurts you if they find you.
He believes in her and he will support her and protect her if need be, if she feels this is what she must do. She was prepping for it. They gathered all the stuff in a bag, like anything that was metal or glass, they wrapped in fabric. So when they were walking, they didn't clang. She's got lint wadding, small jars, bone saw, scalpels, all the things. She has a memory of her conversation with Joe Abernathy about, as she's packing and prepping the bag, she has a memory of a conversation she had with Joe Abernathy about a box of bones, namely one Galus Duncan.
Dem bones.
Yerp. As they enter the shed, they go into the shed. Jamie goes back out and he is pissing on the gateposts. And we know what that's for. It's to keep spirits from, once they're done, following them back to the house.
Good thing she had a dude handy to do that, because it's really hard to piss on anything without a penis.
Well,
unless you're planning on pissing on yourself, because that's
exactly
about,
because
we're
you
real
pretty
good
much pee
on
you pee on everything. That's the thing. Before she touches Betty, Jamie pours out some holy water over the corpse and says a prayer. Hannah S. writes, Claire notices the quote espaliered fruit trees spread black as spider webs against the walls of the house. I didn't know this, but, quote, the art of espalier is when trees and branches are pruned and trained to be on one plane. Huh. So she provides a source for that. I will include that link as well. And she refers to one of Diana's lines about stepping into the kitchen garden felt like, quote, Persephone entering the underworld. So just in case anyone is interested in reading the mythology of Persephone, she includes a link to that as well. So you can brush up on that. And she links the peeing on the doorposts or peeing on the posts, gateposts, to the first time we read this in Diana's works. It was Dragonfly and Amber, chapter 30. Jenny told Claire that peeing on a doorpost will stop a ghost from entering a house. And we have a link for that as well. Of course, you can go back to Dragonfly and Amber if you're interested as well. And she concludes here, or finishes with, inside the shed, someone had placed a small loaf of bread and a cup of brandy beside Betty and a, quote, small posy of dried herbs carefully twisted into a knot just above the heart, unquote. Was this customary? I don't know. What it reminded me of was, and I'm not going to spoil, but there is a scene, which I won't go into detail about, but there's a scene, I think it's in book 6, where it involves a sin eater and it involves bread. They don't use the drink there, but I'm wondering, I'm not saying they were going to have a sin eater here, come here, but I'm wondering if it was, you know, the bread was there to absorb her sins, right? Who knows? That's what it reminded me of. Did that remind you of anything, Sam?
No. And then she mean like coins on her eyes.
That would have been very Greek, huh?
Yeah.
Or I guess Roman. Greek-Roman. Definitely Roman. Maybe not Greek. I think it's both. But it's definitely Roman because they found people buried in England, in Roman burial sites that have coins on their eyes. So definitely at least Roman. Claire placed the gifts that she found on Betty to the side, and Jamie blessed the body with holy water. And she points out the comparison of Jamie as Christ figure here. He says a Gaelic prayer, an invocation to St. Michael. It's the prayer to St. Michael, and I'll link to the source she provided us in case you guys are interested in what that text is. So she begins carving. She gets through the breastbone, and sees enough of the lungs to know that they were black, to see that they were black and grainy. Now, this would have been from her living her life with open wood fires. However, there's no indication of hemorrhage in either lung. No blood in her chest or abdominal cavity either. As she leans on the corpse, it emitted a low groan and freaks Jamie out. She says it was just trapped gas. And then Jamie tells her Jamie remembers a time that he saw a burned corpse sit up. And she confirms, yep, that is something known as postmortem contracture.
But it was in a fire. It was like worse than just sitting up. It was like they lit it on fire and it sat up and like looked at him. Like that is nightmares right there.
Sure. She fingers the stomach and she knows here there's something wrong. This is when she smells ipecac. And she finds something granular in the stomach, in the little fold of the stomach called the rugi. She has a terrible feeling of what it might be. She asks Jamie to get her one of the small jars, and then the door opens, and it's Philip Wiley.
Fucking Philip Wiley. Jesus Christ. Seriously, he has nothing better to do. He has to be following them. There's no reason that he should be showing up everywhere they are, or at least everywhere she is. There's no reason. Other than the fact that he doesn't have a horse to leave with.
Yes. So when she sees him in this most unexpected manner, she has an immediate flashback to the feeling she had at Cranesmere. Quote, fear rippled over me in a chilly wave. I had come close to being burned for witchcraft once before, and that was one time too often, unquote. Now, this is, I think, the first time in book 5 that we have any reference, either in name or in feel. Here it's both, to her being nearly burned as a witch, her being tried as a witch, and to Cranesmere, the village, the town. Obviously, it happens in book 1. There's hella references in book 2. I don't know. I'm sure there's references in book three if we went back and look and looked in some manner. Four. I'm not sure about four. Four is my only one I'm a little iffy on. Five, here it is. Six, sure as heck. And then seven and eight, I don't remember, even though I just listened to those most recently. But all my point is, and I said this in book one when we talked about it, her experience was so, obviously it was like, you know, life, a life and death almost, right? Her experience was so traumatic. 20, 30 years, she still has physical reactions. And this is something that affects her the rest of her life. And here's just another example.
That's just PTSD.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's just, and I'm not saying anyone belittled it, right? I'm not saying anyone said it wouldn't affect her, but I'm just like, legit, you don't, if you may have thought I was overreacting or overstating it in book one. I'm just like, look, I'm connecting it again because it's not me, right? It's Diana. Diana brings it back because it's such a part, unfortunately, it's such a part of Claire's schema now. Like she goes straight back there. She goes straight back there, back to those feelings and that experience when she is in any kind of somewhat similar experience. Hannah S. writes, quote, Ipecac, which I didn't know. It makes sense that it is, but I never actually put it together like this, is a plant. It can be taken by mouth to cause vomiting after suspected poisoning. It contains chemicals that irritate the digestive tract and trigger the brain to cause vomiting. And that is actually her source there is WebMD. We will share that as well. And she also writes, as I was saying, that she finds a granular material. And the quote from Diana is, quote, granular material forming a pale sludge in the furrows of the rugi. As I said, rugi is plural for the folds of the stomach. And I learned this in anatomy. And she quotes, it's a Wikipedia article on the rugi. And she quotes, you know what I mean. In anatomy, rugi are a series of ridges produced by folding of the wall of an organ. Most commonly, rugi refers to the gastric rugi of the internal surface of the stomach. Now, Jamie, luckily, Wiley hadn't seen Jamie because at this moment he comes in, Jamie happens to be, well, he was for some, oh, she had asked him to get a small jar and I believe the bag was down. I could be wrong, but Jamie was, now that he came in, he stayed down. He made sure he was hidden. Well, he was legit hiding.
She like told him to.
She told him not to get up.
Yeah.
She signaled to him to stay put. She didn't tell him to get down. I think he went down to get the a glass jar. But yes, she signaled to him to not move. So Wiley hadn't seen him yet. She asks Wiley what he's doing there. And the latter seems...
She's frogging him out.
Oh, Summer, you still... She asks him what he's doing there. And the latter seems to, like, he's just... He doesn't do it all the way, but he makes a short movement like he's going to look over his shoulder. But he stops himself. But not before Claire sees it and follows, her eyes follow in that direction. Quote, there was a man standing in the darkness behind him, a tall man who stepped forward, his face glimmering pale in the glow of the lantern, sardonic eyes, the green of gooseberries, Stephen Bonnet, unquote.
Mother.
Then Jamie comes out from, all this stuff happens at once. Jamie comes out from under the table. Wiley leaps back from the door and the lantern crashes to the floor and whoosh, there's a fire. Jamie's gone. People are shouting. She drags the burning. She's very smart thinking like this, right? Especially one who was almost burned as a witch. She very smartly, unfortunately, but cleverly, pulls the burning shroud over the body. She grabs her bag and fled with the evidence still in her hand. Like, she's got this granular stuff in her hand. She's like, I got to get this. She's certain. As she leaves, she knows for a fact. She is certain that Betty has been murdered. She just needs to look at this stuff, but she has to wait till she's alone. So the fire is growing, and they end up letting it burn out because there is no way to, other than the body, obviously, that's unfortunate, but there is no way to bring enough water in time to for it to... really put it out. And also, it was a lone structure. It was not in danger, apparently, of leaping to hurting another part of the property. Fedra had come out and seeing that her mother, that her mother's body was, you know, the place where her mother's body was now gone. It had burned down. By feel, Claire gets a jar from her bag because Jamie hadn't gotten one out. She scrapes the contents of her hand into it, closes it, cleans her dirty hands. Because she's like, I can't be found like this, right? I can't be found with like blood and all this stuff. She cleans her hand with the alcohol that she also had packed and then puts it away. And she was like wondering during all this time, I got to do this. And then she looks up and she's like, where were the men? Where were those three men? She ends up like this. So much happening. She faints and then recovers and then she's up and off. She runs into, okay, Summer, tell me, did I miss something? Was there a, did Jocasta scream? Because I don't remember that, but one of the commenters said it and I was like, how did I miss that?
A woman's voice, high and cracked, but strong for all that and full of fury. That was distant shouting. And then Stanhope exclaimed, Mrs. Cameron, but the major was already making a run for the house.
Okay, so she didn't scream. She was yelling. And we don't know what she was yelling. Okay, got it. So as people are running toward the house, Claire runs toward the house. She runs into McDonald and Stanhope, but no one has seen Jamie. And at Jocasta's screams, McDonald and Stanhope are both running toward the house to find and tell Jocasta.
And that was chapter 52. We made it, you guys. All five chapters. All right. Join us next week when we will be continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along by doing three more chapters. We'll be doing 53, The Frenchman's Gold, 54, Tête-à-Tête with Crumb Cake, and 55, entitled Deductions. This is the murder mystery portion of The Fiery Cross. And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can join us on our website, on Facebook, our Facebook group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And if you would like to, I mean, we'd like you to, if you would like to join our exclusive group of supporters, support us in a very special way and support content that you believe in, and content creators that you believe in, for content that is legit created just for you, just for the Outlander fan, please consider supporting us on Patreon. And you can find out more about that at patreon.com/outlanderpod. So thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.